The We Society podcast has had only three short seasons, and thank you all for making it the number one social science podcast in Britain. We'll be back this autumn with a longer run of great conversations with some of social science's best thinkers, academics and researchers who are working in the field. I'm Will Hutton, economist, writer and president of the Academy of Social Sciences, the organisation committed to advancing the cause of social science in all its manifestations. And in this recap episode, I wanted to share with you some of my favourite interviews from the past three seasons to give a flavour of what we mean when we say social science is everywhere. You'll hear from the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, economist Mariana Mazzucato, international migration expert Heaven Crawley, and sociologist Gary Young. The North Star that guides the podcast and social science is that we are a we society. Interconnectedness is at the heart of the human experience. Of course, as individuals, we have agency, but within a we society. Our aim is to show the thousands of ways the social sciences develop that insight into not just understanding, but enhancing the complicated human networks and values they create in which we all live. So here is our selection, beginning with a woman whose career has been linked to the social sciences inextricably. Hillary Clinton majored in political science back in 1965 at Wellesley College, and eventually, after a journey full of twists and turns, became a contender for President of the United States of America in 2016. You don't need me to tell you how that turned out. In my podcast interview with her in 2022, a UK exclusive, she spoke of how performance politics was eroding democracy. Hillary Clinton, what does the We Society mean to you?
Well, it means that whether we care to acknowledge it or not, we are truly all in this together. And in a democracy, the we is those of us who are citizens and the leaders that we choose to govern us. And if you recall, the preamble to our United States Constitution begins, "We the people." So you're talking about the we society is rooted in very fundamental values about how we come together in solidarity to take collective action for the common good. And it is now in peril because of all of the developments socially, technologically, politically, economically, that have elevated individualism far above social needs or social desires. And so I think your podcast is particularly timely.
How do you unpack that? I mean, what's actually driving this? I mean, there's four or five things you identified there. But I mean, you know, the polarization in American society, and by the way, British society, is kind of mounting. Mm-hmm. Is it excess individualism? Is it technology? How can one kind of close these fissures? I mean, people talk about potential civil war in America, probably overstated. Mm-hmm. But that they could even talk about and not get laughed out of the room is a proxy for how serious things are. Your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
It's the combination of all of this. I mean, human nature has not changed dramatically in the last 50, 100, 200 years, but there have been a number of developments which sadly have elevated those leaders who play on people's fears rather than addressing them, who emphasize divisiveness over unity. And in particular, in our country, the combination of right-wing media led by Fox News, but also amplified by social media and deliberate efforts at disinformation and propaganda have kept people off balance. And then along comes the pandemic, which has been further destabilizing to many individuals, families, communities. So it's a witch's brew, isn't it? It's a combination of longer-term economic and social trends, but it's also been amplified in ways by social media that I don't think any of us truly expected.
I just want to pick your point up on the pandemic. I mean, in a sense, you know, I mean, the success of the vaccination program and actually the way in which those societies which actually emphasized we-ness and actually acted collectively and promptly mm-hmm. actually did better. I thought it might be the opportunity to kind of bring societies like the United States or the UK society together, but it has probably not done that. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, I think it's because when the pandemic began, we had a leader in the White House who chose to deny and diminish the impact of the pandemic, who played again to people's fears, who tried to defy science, who himself recommended crackpot kinds of...
Those are astonishing interventions.
You know, solutions like injecting yourself with bleach. you can't make this up. And he used to have a press conference every night, which I haven't looked at the exact figures, but I bet a really high percentage of Americans tuned into. And some of us couldn't believe our eyes, but others believed him. And the war on science, which goes hand in hand with efforts to create a post-fact world, I think is part and parcel of the kind of populism and demagoguery that we saw in the United States. And tragically, you know, based on reports I've read, we lost now more than a million people to the pandemic. And most of them, after vaccines came in to use. This remarkable scientific achievement of creating vaccines in literally, faster time than anyone could have predicted, which the Trump administration could have and should have taken credit for, because it did start in terms of their push and their emphasis and investment in tax dollars into some of the pharmaceutical companies working on vaccines. But instead, you had a president who would not take a shot in public, although we know indeed he got it. And you had right-wing media led by Rupert Murdoch, who, as I understand it, was one of the very first people in the UK who got his vaccine and then permitted his broadcast network after vaccination was required of all of his employees, but permitted those on air to continue to sow doubt about vaccines. So, you know, what we're living in is a kind of alternative reality, and it advantages certain people. It advantages certain media outlets and social media ad revenues. It advantages certain politicians who play on those fears and create more divisiveness. And they get rewarded.
I'm trying to get behind kind of why they are so passionate, why they think they're so passionately right. I mean, there are people
who the right-wing leaders or their followers?
Yeah,
most of them don't believe they're passionately right. It's opportunism. You know, it is so much easier to stoke people's fears and anger than it is to provide hope and constructive alternatives. It is so much easier. And you have to be especially skilled in performance arts in today's politics to be able to promote hopefulness. You know, my husband was very skilled, Barack Obama was very skilled, but the performance side of politics has now superseded, in many instances, any kind of productivity. Yeah. And it is so much easier to attract and keep an audience. And then if you watch what happens on social media, you have people literally being led by algorithms into deeper and deeper conspiracies and, you know, social media rabbit holes that are aimed to ensnare them. And we see it in political campaigns, but we also see it now on a regular basis by people who are profiting. Look at the anti-vaxxers in the United States. You know, they are now trying to convince parents not to have their children vaccinated for all the childhood diseases. And there was a recent study, I think, in the New York Times, which looked at the 12 biggest personalities on social media, primarily Facebook, but not exclusively, who are peddling anti-vaccination propaganda, they are all making money from it in one way or the other. They are selling products like vitamins and lotions and potions instead of vaccines. And so this human nature to, you know, promote oneself, to try to turn a profit, has just been put on steroids because of our media ecosystem right now.
Now, a topic that has refused to die down this year is migration. With the climate crisis intensifying and war even reaching the gates of Europe, millions around the world have become displaced. While Britain opened its doors to Ukrainians through the Homes for Ukraine scheme, other avenues into the country were firmly shut. I spoke to Professor Heaven Crawley, Head of Equitable Development and Migration at the United Nations University, who dispelled some long-held myths.
If you are being told effectively, you know, spurious tales of numbers and scales of migration that simply aren't in line with what's happening in the world, then of course you're going to be anxious. And therefore, you know, politicians of all colours will sort of latch onto this as a potential way of getting your sympathy and empathy and ultimately your vote. The truth is that 97% of the world's population doesn't move. Far more, you know, people don't go anywhere than do go somewhere. And in fact, historically, migration has always been a driver of development. You know, in the global south, we see that now, but just look at what's happened in the global north. How did the global north come to be what it was in terms of its relative power in the world? And that was largely through migration, through exploration, through colonialism, and all that went with it. So, you know, I think there's a historical context that's important. There's a geographical context that's important because most people don't move, or if they do move, they move within the countries of the global south. And then there's a sort of, you know, political context, which is understanding that the motivations and the drivers for these migration, these largely anti-migration narratives, are not necessarily rooted in the evidence about what the consequences of migration are, but a series of other kind of objectives, which I think are motivated by other factors. I mean, I've been doing research on this topic for 35 years now. I don't know everything, of course I don't, but I mean, I have a pretty good grasp of what the evidence tells us. And yes, there are, of course, issues associated with migration that are not unproblematic, you know, particularly in terms of, you know, various kinds of social integration. But many of the things that are positive about migration simply don't get spoken about. And the things that are spoken about in a negative way are often a very small part of what's actually going on. And so, yes, there are issues around migration, but it's a very skewed representation of what the evidence tells us. And I think really kind of trying to engage, you know, national governments, but also the UN system and different audiences in these alternative, more nuanced approaches to migration is what's needed, because what we have at the moment isn't really getting us anywhere terribly effectively in terms of the policy.
There's a spectrum, isn't there? There's asylum seekers and then there's kind of illegal migration, and then there's legal migration. And I would like to think that a government of a different political hue might have taken a less emotional kind of stance to the what's called the small boats crisis. But nonetheless, I mean, you do see the political salience of it. I mean, the numbers crossing on small boats across the English Channel into the UK it's risen every year since 1918, and since 2018, to 45,000. And so, I mean, yeah, it's quite tricky for a government to say, we're not going to do anything about this.
So they're I'm not for one moment suggesting that that should be the approach. But I mean, I think, you know, I've been working on the issue of migration to the UK for a long time. And I specifically undertook a very large piece of work called the MedMig Project in 2015-16 around the very significant increase in arrivals of migrants across the Mediterranean, particularly to Italy and to Greece. So, you know, we know why people move and we know the drivers of migration and all that goes with it. Now, what's happened since 2018, it's not an accident. It's not an accident that suddenly the numbers have started to increase crossing the channel to get to the UK. It's a consequence of all sorts of policies that are not necessarily even migration related, or ironically were intended to stop migration. I'm talking here about Brexit, because one of the things that Brexit did, and of course was not spoken about and is still not spoken about, is it removed the UK from the Dublin Convention, essentially, which is about the arrival of third country nationals. Now, that means that you can't, as a government, return people to the country from which they came, in this case, France. Now, one of the things that we know that happens when people are making decisions about why they might go, and we're talking specifically here about asylum seekers, who are, of course, the smallest proportion of migrants altogether. But one of the things that we know is that they are given information by smugglers, by people traffickers, by others, about where they should spend their money in order to get the best opportunity to rebuild their lives, right? Remember that more than 80% of all those who arrive across the channel get refugee status, right? So these are not people who have no reason to seek protection. They're very much looking for an opportunity to rebuild their lives. And the smugglers know the deal. You go to the UK, you can't be returned because the UK has withdrawn from the Dublin Convention. So at what point are we going to have an honest conversation about the broader political processes that have led to this current situation, which is being dealt with in the way that it is? And in short, we're not going to have that conversation, because it's much easier, isn't it, to blame other people rather than looking at government policy itself. So, you know, I am under no illusions. The new policies, the new Illegal Migration Act, won't make any difference any more than any of the other multiple waves of legislation over the last 20 years have done, because nobody's looking at the root causes. Nobody's looking at establishing safe and legal routes. The only people who can get to the UK legally are the Ukrainians, and even that has become much lower in numbers. So unless, if we're serious about wanting to address this issue, then we have to address the reasons why people move in the first place. In this case, refugees or asylum seekers who are needing protection, most of whom get it when they arrive. I'd like an honest conversation about that rather than this kind of, you know, spurious narrative headlines that don't really engage with any of those broader factors.
Professor Gary Young may now be a sociology professor at the University of Manchester, but he's not shaken off his journalistic past, winning the Orwell Journalism Prize in 2023. He was heralded for bringing the eloquence of an expert journalist and the depth of an academic to his reporting on the role of racism and inequality in the pandemic. Given his unique vantage point of two worlds, academia and journalism, I asked him if he thought life was becoming more equal for black people in contemporary Britain.
I would say no. The reason being that it's got harder for everybody, right? Cost of living crisis on. And I think that the way in which it gets harder for everybody, because black people tend to be poorer, and that's a consequence of who our parents were, and, you know, children of bus drivers do less well than children of bankers, you know, and my parents in my generation were more likely to be bus drivers than nurses. So there is a kind of generational reason why, broadly speaking, people from the Caribbean, particularly Bangladeshi, Pakistani, do worse. Indian, African, slightly better, considerably better, some of them. So when things get bad for everybody, they get considerably worse for black people. There is what Paul Gilroy calls a conviviality, which grows. We feel better, generally speaking, as a society about ourselves. We are more comfortable in our personal relationships. Mixed race relationships in Britain are higher than anywhere else in Europe, and certainly higher than in America as a kind of proportion of our population. That in a range of ways, we feel better. But then when you look at the stats, we're not doing better. And there was a YouGov did a survey just after Black Lives Matter, and the proportion of people who thought that things were still pretty bad racially who were black was almost the same as people who as I think 30 years ago. Ah. I think now some of that is about kind of goalpost shifting.
I mean, it's impressive, however, if you take the Premier League, the way they the players continue to take the knee.
Mm.
And actually, of course, there's, you know, we know there's racism in the football, but I'm, you know, I go along to the watch the Arsenal. I'm really quite, you know, I mean, the Arsenal crowds are kind of devoted to their black stars. I mean, there's no sense, you know, they're bloody good footballers and they'd love to have them, you know, and there's this kind of, and I do think that's a bit better than it was. I mean, but there's a lot of other damn crap stuff going on, I know. But I sometimes feel good about the way the Arsenal crowd have reacted to the black team, or largely, you know, the black stars.
I honestly think that, there's a range of ways in which I've emphasised in my work and in this podcast, ways in which things are troubling and are bad. They're not uniformly bad, and they're not uniquely bad. There are things about this country that are brilliant in terms of race, and there are major achievements that have been made in terms of race, and those have to be celebrated. Otherwise, there's this sense that we're never going anywhere. But what we can't do, a la Sewell, is take those success stories and say, so that actually negates all the other stuff. So in America, when people used to ask me, African Americans in particular, where would you rather be black? And I would say, well, in England, I was the son of a single mum, three boys. Statistically, in America, one of us would have ended up dead or in jail, statistically. That's not true in Britain. I had a hernia when I was 8. It was fixed by the NHS. It didn't bankrupt my family. My mother was a nocturnal epileptic. She got the meds. She worked. Didn't bankrupt the family. When I got the grades, I could go to university. I went to the university of my choice. When my mother died when I was 19, I was given more money to stay at university. In a range of ways, not because of race, but because of class, actually. All of those things that I got were because we were working class, or because we were British and therefore we have an NHS. All of those things were possible in Britain in a way in which they weren't in America. Some of them are no longer possible, actually, but they were when I was growing up. But then you get to a point in Britain where it doesn't really know what to do with you. You come out of university, and that next step is actually very, very hard. Yeah. And whereas in America, if you get through, then then all bets are off.
Yeah, you can really earn it.
Which is why you see so many talented Britons, black Britons. This is particularly true in the acting world, but not uniquely. End up in America, because they get to a certain point, and then Britain becomes very difficult. But there is another thing, which is just it would be negligent to miss, which was the Windrush scandal, because the Windrush scandal sent a chill through all of us. One of my cousins was caught up in it, but it sent a chill through all of us because it gave a clear indication of how contingent our presence here might be. How at some point you might have to prove where you've been for the last 30 years, that the people who've known you, who've employed you for 25 years, say, if you don't have this piece of paper, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go, and that suddenly you can lose everything. And that was incredibly chilling.
We don't just dwell on problems in the We Society, but speak to those with solutions for the most pressing issues of our times. And Mariana Mazzucato, a professor at the Economics of Innovation and Public Value at University College London, is one of the people with solutions. She spoke to me about how we should be focusing on missions.
We would never have gotten to the moon, which was really hard, back in the 60s and in 69, had we had the kind of governance structures we have today on the ground, in government, in business, and how they work together. So to get to the moon, we required massive government leadership. Kennedy talked about, we're going to do it because it's hard, not because it's easy. It required lots of different sectors. It wasn't just aerospace. 400,000 people worked on it. But what was interesting is the first thing that government did was change the tools on the ground. They literally designed procurement to be different from how it was being used, to be more outcomes oriented. They put into the contracts between public and private no excess profits, and they were very aware. By the way, not no profits, no excess profits. Yeah, in other words, let's not turn this into a gambling machine, right? But also they were very aware in NASA that they would never have been able even to know which private sector organizations to work with if they themselves were stupid. So they were aware that they were starting to outsource too much to the private sector. And the head of procurement, this guy called Ernest Brackett, said, if we continue that, we're going to get captured by brochuremanship. And I think what we have today in countries like the UK.
Brochuremanship.
Yeah, not PowerPoint.
You mean what? They pitch with a brochure.
Exactly.
And so you're going to get these wonderful things,
yeah.
And you pay for it, and you pay an excess profit, but that was all in the brochure.
Exactly, because if you don't know what you're doing and you don't understand your landscape, what management theorists call absorptive capacity. So absorptive capacity was a concept invented by business school folks when they realized that companies like Dell computers weren't kind of really making things anymore. They were just assembling things that were already made and innovated by others. And so they said, if you have companies that stop doing their own research and development, they're just not even going to understand their landscape. They won't understand even the opportunities that are out there. So I've used that concept for the public sector. If you just outsource and use Deloitte to do your test and trace, or ask McKinsey to run your climate strategy, or ask Serco and G4S to run your prisons or, you know, the Olympic security, and so on, then you stop doing. And if you stop doing, you stop learning by doing. And if on top of that, as soon as you make a mistake.
You make the state kind of stupid.
You make the state stupid, which, by the way, a Tory conservative lord in the UK, you'll know, said this recently, Lord Agnew. He said, if we continue to outsource government capacity.
He was the minister, he was an anti-corruption minister, as I recall.
Yes. And
he resigned because he couldn't monitor the scale of the surpluses and the scale of malfeasance going on in the in public procurement over in the during the COVID crisis.
Was that the Whitehall had been infantilized.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually opened the book up with that, which is we have infantilized governments worldwide, not just Whitehall, by overly consultifying them. My next book is actually on the history of consulting. But already, you know, it kind of in this book, but also in the work that I've been doing globally and looking at examples on the ground where actually we have that capacity and how we have to learn how to build it. Because, you know, any company will know that they need capabilities and capacity. If you go take an MBA course, a master's in business administration, which is the courses that managers take, they're trained to think about kind of value creation in their companies. They take courses like strategic management, decision sciences, organizational behavior. They're trained to think about the problems that happen when a company becomes too big. There's a famous textbook called Rejuvenating the Mature Corporation. Instead, when a public sector institution becomes too big and inertial, we just say, oh, it's a bureaucracy. It's bureaucratic. We don't realize that we can transform our bureaucracies to be much more agile, creative, flexible. But that's impossible to do if the narrative of the public sector is at best a market fixer, an enabler of the private sector, a de-risker of the risk takers. And so, you know,
so the public sector,
a redistributor.
I get it. So the public sector can act like NASA did when it actually kind of mobilized by Kennedy, kind of organized the Apollo moonshot. That's your basic kind of.
And you can
broaden that out.
Yeah.
You can make that same kind of approach could be applicable to a kind of how you rejuvenate universities, how you organize attack on climate change, how you could organize healthcare. I mean, is that your.
So the book says, look, if we did it to get to the moon and back, which is so much harder than delivering personal protection equipment to frontline workers, perhaps it's also that it's only when we see problems as urgent or someone frames it as a security risk. You know, at the time it was beat the Russians, but they didn't stop at beat the Russians or let's go to space before them. They made it a very clear moonshot, which was getting to the moon and back in a short amount of time. And second, they had to get lots of sectors together. It wasn't just like one sector, big project, kind of put all your eggs in one basket. And third, they were able to catalyze bottom-up innovation. So it's not about top-down micromanaging, big state telling everyone what to do, but it's a confident state setting a direction, being clear what the goal is, but then opening up the process to as many different businesses as possible and redesigning the tools. Procurement, grants, loans, bailout programs during COVID-19 recovery should be outcomes oriented as well. And so that kind of confidence, that confidence that government had in going to the moon, we don't have today. They are constantly getting captured by British airmanship. They also don't know how to negotiate the deals. And we've just had these massive COVID-19 recovery packages with very little conditions attached. So just subsidies, guarantees, loans. And yet we talk about Build Back Better, but don't realize how to do that at the contract level.
It was a wasted opportunity and not much seems to have been learned. I mean, I was quite struck by a piece that Andy Haldane wrote, kind of commenting on the success of the vaccine program. How actually it had taken, you know, government smart procurement, upfront royalties on, you know, you the developer of the vaccine, you can get upfront royalties that we'll pay you, so you've got the funds to develop this vaccine, you know, and the whole damn thing was a kind of exercise, and actually, in a sense, it was a mission. We've got to have a vaccine in play within 12 months.
Well, the problem is, so I'm currently, I mean, because you're absolutely feeding now my, I don't want to say anger, but disillusionment, which is the mission was not the vaccine. The mission should be, during a global health pandemic, to vaccinate the whole world. So that would require, again, a very different type of contract, a very different type of conditionality, a very different type of design of the collaboration, a very different type of intellectual property rights system. And so if the mission is vaccinate the whole world, we need to backtrack and say, what does it mean for, again, the design of the system?
And to finish, here is Ai Weiwei, the famous Chinese dissident who really needs no introduction. He reminded me how the idea of we is used by communist China to suppress any other worldview except that of the party. It's complicated. At the same time, he understands the need to express the we as we understand it in the podcast, to promote a better society while respecting individuality. This gives a flavour of his thinking.
In my mind, you know, when I grew up, there's no such thing as I. The I is always would be criticized and self-criticized, but we always talk about the we. Still today, you know, China, the new government mentioned people in this speech about 150 times. So the people is equal to the words we. So they are reinterpreted their position which they represent as we. But when I went to United States in 1981, I hate to see anything related to we. We want to say I. I want to do this and want to do that. So the individualism is always attractive to any people want to break away from the way.
I understand that. I understand that perfectly. I mean, what we try to do in the we society and what we try to do as social scientists is we try to think through how you kind of reconcile the necessity of there being a we with the necessity of respecting individual autonomy, and getting that blend right between the I and the we is the secret to the good society. Maybe, I don't know, maybe your view is perhaps different. We're having, I mean, your experience is so different from mine and so many people listening to you.
Even you talk about not just my experience, you talk about why China is like China today. So they still think we in China are very different. They reflect very different values. You know, it's about a whole set of common sense or values are completely different. So that's why they still think the West is a potential enemy, because that way is different from our way.
But in a sense, you kind of live a greater truth, which is that, you know, human beings, wherever they are, need liberty. When I was working on my book in China, I wrote a book 10 years ago called The Writing on the Wall. I was introduced to a number of Chinese intellectuals and Chinese officials, you know, who said, you know, don't give up on your campaign to argue for democratic institutions in China. We want them too. And they would say this privately. I remember once I was walking to an official's car, and he took me by my hand and held me back and said, just for, we only had 30 seconds to speak without someone hearing him. And he said, I don't think that the language you hear from the party is the language that we believe in. We want democratic institutions. We want the rule of law, not the rule by law, but the rule of law. We want checks and balances. We want freedom of the press. You know, these are universal kind of desires. I was very, very struck by this. Lived on with me all my life. And now I'm sitting in front of you in this room in Cambridge. What are you thinking when I say this?
Well, there's, of course, there's certain truth in there. You know, we all, for me, I always think it's better to have a democracy or to have individual freedom, freedom of speech or freedom of expression. This is a very essential meaning for life, because that reflects why an individual is an individual. But at the same time, we also would questioning its liberty or democracy a fixed concept, like very general in the West. When you talk about liberty, that means you have liberty, the others doesn't have it, or you have a democracy and the others doesn't have it, which are not all true. And there's also very strong culture characters in there, you know, with history, with our how we become a society like today, either in the West or in China. So those factors has to be clearly dealt with or think of. So because it doesn't really come as a surprise. It has been a long history. And that history, through human struggle, come out very different conclusion and so-called intelligence, because you have to assume everybody's equipped with their own rationality and argument. So that makes the world much complex. That's how I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So we cannot simplify who has a freedom or democracy, but rather to deal with how they would function under their argument.
I mean, here you are living in the West now, and there are fears that if Donald Trump runs again in 2024, he may be the last freely elected American president, and you watch in Western Europe, you know, the right, the nationalist right, who are indifferent really to democratic freedoms and checks and balances, on the rise. Do you think we in the West are kind of colluding in the decline of our liberties?
I think certainly there are hidden problems there. You know, it's, society almost like the weather. You have a spring, you have a summer, you of course after summer is autumn, you know, and the winter follows. So we can never really just stretch it. You can stretch it for a few days, but still you have to accept this is some kind of circle there. So I think the West enjoyed the great moment after the Enlightenment or later the New World Order or globalization, which is extension of the
Western values.
Yeah, values, but be more clear, capitalism.
Yeah.
So, but the capitalism have a potential problems because it's about free enterprise and the competition. And when China are equipped it with this to become as a unit, as a way, one special way, they competed it with the Western democratic society, and they present a much more efficient, decisive, and powerful, because they are unified as one person. The whole China, 1.4 billion people as one. And here you have a much divided interests and the different companies, different interests. So the competition less efficient appear to be. So that's why China become a problem.
To listen to the full episodes, search the We Society on all popular podcast platforms. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences. And please tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Please join us again for Season 4 in the autumn.